Cyberspace is a quickly evolving landscape that poses various forms of threats. From cyber terrorism to online propaganda, it's a challenging arena to combat these dangers. Tune in to today's episode as we explore terrorism in the cyber world.
This is Director Jared Maples of the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness. Welcome back to Season 3 of Intelligence Unclassified, a podcast about counterterrorism, cybersecurity, and emergency preparedness. Join us as we talk to local and national experts in these fields to discuss New Jersey's diverse threat landscape and offer you a unique perspective on current trends and issues facing our great state. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed, iTunes, or Google Play. You can also follow NJOHSP on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at NJOHSP. All links can be found in the show notes and on our website, www.njohsp.gov.
This is the last of the threat assessment podcast that we have for you from our 2018 New Jersey Terrorism Threat Assessment. Here today, we have Krista from the NJKIC, also known as the New Jersey Cybersecurity and Communication Integration Cell. And I also have with me Matt, an analyst here at OHSP. We're going to start off by talking about cyber attacks with Krista. Are any terrorists conducting cyber attacks or committing technology-enabled crime, using technology for operations or to evade law enforcement?
So for the past few years, especially the past 5 years, I would say, we've been seriously concerned about terrorists using cyberspace to commit any sort of cyber attacks and further their own mission. And we have only seen in the past couple of years them conducting these low-level cyber attacks, which is surprising in some ways and in some ways not. They've been more successful, particularly with ISIS in the past few years, in conducting the physical attacks. So I don't think that they've pursued the cyberspace as much as we had anticipated that they would. We do see low-level attacks such as denial-of-service attacks, where you flood a network or a website with traffic and it makes that website go down. So it's inaccessible. Or we've seen defacements of websites where they change the content of a website to something that might be ISIS-related. So they might put up some ISIS or other terrorist networks propaganda on that website and deface it. But we haven't seen the sophisticated cyber attacks like we would see even cyber criminals conducting, nor especially not to the level of nation state activity for sure.
So a DDoS attack would be something on the level of unsophisticated. And what would be the more sophisticated, like the most sophisticated that we would see?
DDoS attacks are less sophisticated. That's what we consider a low level, less sophisticated attack. For the higher level, it varies. I mean, even ransomware, which we've seen a lot of in the past few years, we haven't seen terrorists engaging in ransomware attacks. Typically, those are financially motivated attacks. But at the same time, you are taking away a company's ability to operate when they're hit with a ransomware attack. So that could be used to further their own missions, and we haven't seen that being conducted. That I wouldn't consider being super technical, but it is more technical than what we're seeing from them. We've seen terrorists using cyberspace to further their operations for communication purposes because they can communicate covertly through different means in cyberspace. So their operations can be coordinated through technology, through the use of technology, as well as the recruitment. So they've obviously, and we'll talk about this more, been recruiting a lot online using technology to further their mission, but not necessarily conducting cyber attacks.
Moving on, how might terror groups find inspiration in recent cyber attacks?
In the last year especially, we've seen two big ransomware incidents that were actually perpetrated by nation state actors. One of those was WannaCry and the other was NotPetya, which was a pseudo ransomware attack. So I would see terror groups finding inspiration through those attacks because there are means for them to purchase these kits and tools that would facilitate the automation of instigating a ransomware attack. And they don't even need to, in the traditional sense, be able to provide their targets with decryption tools after they've received the money, which is typical of ransomware. They might just commit that ransomware act and have no intention of ever being able to give that target their data back. So I would see them, terror groups as well as cyber criminal groups, seeing inspiration in those attacks.
So we could see this tactic being used by terror groups to finance their efforts, their missions, if they were able to pick up and facilitate a ransomware attack, then they could certainly use that to fund their operations.
Yeah, terror groups can use ransomware in definitely two ways. So one of those is what you just mentioned. So they could use ransomware in its traditional form and extort any different company, different targets out of money through ransom and facilitate their own operations, finance their operations. Or in the case of the NotPetya incident, where it was pseudo ransomware, it was really wiper malware. It was intended to destruct data and never be able to give that data back to the organization. So depending on the target of the terrorist group, they might want to go one of two avenues. So do they want to prevent a company from doing operations that might be in contrast to what their own beliefs are, or do they want to finance their activity?
How do you see cyber terrorism evolving?
I see cyber terrorism evolving in kind of the way that I was mentioning before, because we are seeing a lot of different automation tools available to very low level hackers, which would include cyber terrorists. And they can use these tools to conduct the attacks that we would normally see by more advanced cyber actors. So that it could be the ransomware, it could be different Trojans to put a backdoor on a company. Companies' networks, that they have access to that network. There are a variety of ways that cyber terrorism could evolve. Recently, Site Intel Group put out an article about a pro-ISIS tech group publishing a manual for scanning suspicious URLs for malware, and including in that was the URL shortening services. So this doesn't indicate their activity, but it does indicate their level of awareness of different threats in the cyberspace. So I can see that maybe as an indicator that they're becoming more aware of these different cyber threats. So it could evolve in a number of ways, but we could also see what we've been seeing kind of in the last few years where it hasn't evolved in the way that we thought it would. If they're continuing to be successful in the physical space, it doesn't necessarily make sense for them to put in the time and the effort into becoming more advanced in this space. So we'll have to see how it evolves.
Krista, what is the most challenging issue for law enforcement when it comes to cyber threats and cyberspace?
So for law enforcement, terrorist groups are becoming more knowledgeable about the ways that they can communicate online covertly with the use of encryption and encryption-based apps such as WhatsApp, Telegram. They're also going on to the dark web via Tor. And using Tor as well as VPNs or proxies, it's relatively simple to hide your origin and who you are. So they're becoming more savvy in this, and they're using these different platforms to communicate, to plan their operations, and that allows them to stay in the dark for law enforcement. As well as when law enforcement is trying to apprehend these individuals, it's becoming a lot more difficult. And that's not just for specific terrorists, that's also for terrorist sympathizers that are communicating and trying to act in their own homeland on behalf of a terrorist organization, etc.
Thanks, Krista. Also, so we spoke about law enforcement when it comes to cyber threats, and now we're going to be moving into cyber threats as it relates to cyber terrorism. In addition to the overarching cyber threat of cyber terrorism, we've seen social media companies have removed extremist content and suspended accounts, forcing extremists to move their internet activities to less active platforms and limiting their potential influence. Since June, Google has removed 150,000 extremist videos, and from August 2015 to February 2016, Twitter suspended over 636,000 accounts promoting terrorism.
So it seems like social media companies are really taking this proactive step in kind of removing this extremist content. Alyssa, as our social media expert, what is extremist content, and where really can you tend to find it on social media?
So extremist content is really anything violent that you find on social media platforms or online that is going to incite someone to do something violent. We've seen this especially with ISIS and their beheading videos. They caught on very quickly and a lot of people were viewing them, and it took a lot of time to get those removed off social media, especially YouTube and Facebook in particular. Twitter was, I think, a little bit faster in bringing that content down. But really, ISIS was at the forefront in bringing this content online. And then that triggered this whole removal process because people were upset. They didn't want to see this stuff online. They didn't want their kids watching it. And they didn't want anybody to become radicalized as a result.
So, Alyssa, when we're talking about extremist content, would the images that we see of ISIS dropping drone bombs and images of their propaganda images, when those are taken down, is that considered extremist content as well?
Yes, that would be considered extremist content, especially if it's coming from a group or a handle that even has or hints at being associated with a foreign terrorist organization because it's just promoting that kind of propaganda and furthering their cause.
There was something else that I was thinking. So before the rise of ISIS, where you really had all these violent beheading videos and shooting videos and all the ones that were just inherently violent on the surface, really people tended to see extremist content from Al-Qaeda as more discussion-based, correct? One of their main clerics, Anwar al-Awlaki, was really big into pushing out videos that called for either some type of violence or rise against, but he wasn't conducting any violence himself. He was mainly just discussing. Is that still what we tend to see today? Or as things move now more to the more, you know, violent beheading type videos that we see from ISIS?
So we still see from Al-Qaeda core and its affiliates less violent videos than, say, ISIS. You won't see the same content online or being pushed online as ISIS. ISIS just happened to be more tech savvy and their video quality was better. Al-Qaeda was more interested in pushing a message rather than showing something like on video. They were really more about the ideology than the pictures and things like that. And even when they did show videos, they were videos of Al-Qaeda training camps and things like that. But they certainly weren't, I wouldn't consider them violent.
All right, so Alyssa, you mentioned the foreign terrorist organizations, but Matt, what about domestic terrorists? Are they using the same platforms and pushing the same type of information?
So yeah, a lot of domestic extremist groups are also using the internet and different social media platforms to really kind of advocate for this violent ideology and reach out to other like-minded individuals. They'll use many of the mainstream platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, Reddit to kind of just throw their information out there and just see who kind of latches onto it and comes back to them. We have seen a lot of this extremist content either have some negative implications towards the group or kind of been taken off a line. And it's pushed these individuals to some of the more third-party applications where they're either encrypted or they're secured or it's invitation only. While this does limit their ability to reach out to more individuals, they're still doing the exact same thing on here where they're pushing out either propaganda or videos or statements or some type of recruitment work that they can use to really bring people into their group and either, you know, engage in violent activities, build their numbers.
So are you seeing the domestic terrorists using those larger platforms, or do you see them going to the smaller platforms where the individuals who might be traversing those sites are more like-minded individuals already and just aren't necessarily associated with a domestic terrorist organization?
So really, you tend to see a lot of domestic terrorists and domestic extremists using a wide variety of different platforms. Many of them are on the mainstream social media platforms where they can kind of just throw that content out there. But we've seen, especially since last year, a lot of these extremist groups, particularly white supremacist extremists, have begun to kind of go off the mainstream and go into the more secure third-party websites. While there are a lot of like-minded individuals on there, it just seems like they're kind of going there for more safety and security, anonymity sometimes at some points, and it still allows them to essentially do exactly what they were doing, but just to a lesser audience.
After Charlottesville, did you see like more of an organization of the white supremacist groups within the United States and then them pushing out content in a different way?
Yeah, a lot of them moved to some, like I said, some of the third-party websites. For example, there's this one social media platform where their main goal is to be a free speech platform, as they call it. It was essentially created to kind of go against Facebook and Twitter because they had a lot of regulations. We see a lot of the white supremacists specifically move to this website because it allows them to kind of post more, While the site still has a lot of terms and conditions that don't allow them to push exactly what they want, we see them using it as kind of a third-party area to them go. So once they're kicked off the mainstream web for whatever reason, they'll move here and they'll say, hey guys, I was kicked off Facebook, I was kicked off Twitter, my YouTube account's been shut down. Here's all my information. Here's where you can find me either at this foreign server or this unregulated website, or even sometimes the dark web, they'll push content on there. And that's just one example of a website we see. You know, there's dozens, hundreds, maybe even of other websites that are just like this, or ones that are kind of being adapted or taken to cater to the specific needs of different extremist groups. So I discussed a lot of how these groups were kind of kicked off of the mainstream platforms and had to move to either the third party or even the dark web for some like more safety and security. Alyssa, why were they kicked off the platforms to begin with? What kind of constituted them to kind of be removed from there?
So companies have what's called terms of service, and those are basically the rules that a company has that allows users to get on their platform, but they can't do certain things. So Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, any of the mainstream or even non-mainstream social media sites or platforms have what they call terms of service. So if you are creating a username and password, you're basically agreeing to those terms of services. So if you violate that, which, you know, when social media first began, they were probably very loose terms of service. But as this violent content has appeared, they've had to tighten up their terms of service. So therefore, when someone sees a violent video or an ISIS beheading or something that's inciting violence, they can report it online, and then the company has to review it and see if it does indeed violate their terms of service.
So to kind of piggyback off that, to give you a real world example of just how violating the terms of service can get you kicked off of the internet, a well-known prominent neo-Nazi website that's been around since about 2013, following the Charlottesville rally, they actually posted an article on their website discussing the individual who was killed in the vehicle ramming there. And the article was filled with such intense hate speech for her that the Register, once they viewed it and they got reports about it, they said, due to this article, you violated all your terms of service. You now have X amount of days to remove yourself from our Register and find a new place to kind of house your website. And luckily, since then, that website has jumped from different Register to Register, not being able to find a real home either in the United States or on a foreign server. They do have a presence on the dark web, but the dark web is used by far less individuals than the mainstream media. So luckily, they haven't been able to reach out to as wide of an audience with their hate speech as in the past.
On page 30 of the New Jersey threat assessment that we've released this year, we have an entire page dedicated to removing extremist content. On there, you'll find some examples, some we've talked about here today. There's also some resources on how you can actually report the content with just a few clicks. And then usually the internet service provider or the social media platform will then give you some kind of report as to whether they've reviewed it or removed it. I just did this the other day on Twitter when I saw something that I thought was inappropriate, inciting violence, and then I got a report back. The other thing is that we always encourage suspicious activity reporting. If you see something on Facebook or any social media platform, we encourage you to call us. We're available 24 hours a day for those reports at 1-866-4-SAFE-NJ or www.njohsp.gov, or you can download our smartphone app, SAFE-NJ, and report it that way. And Krista has some resources over at The Kick, which they're available always as well.
Our website is cyber.nj.gov. We have a bunch of resources there that go well beyond cyber terrorism and talk about all different cyber threats that are out there right now. We also put out a weekly bulletin on Thursdays, and you can sign up for membership for the NJ Kick via our website, cyber.nj.gov. Membership is free. It will get you that weekly bulletin and any other alerts that are pertinent. Also, the Director of National Intelligence puts out a DNI threat assessment for each year. And in 2018, the cyberterrorism section concurred with much of what we said in our assessment for the 2018 threat assessment from OHSP on page 29. I highly suggest checking out the DNI threat assessment via their website. You can also follow them on Twitter at odnigov.
As far as extremism and the internet use, we have a couple of go-to people that we've mentioned before. One is J.M. Berger. He can be found on Twitter at IntelWire. And the other is Clint Watts, who can be found on Twitter at SelectedWisdom. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, please go onto iTunes and rate us. Also, if you want to contact us to find out more information, or if you have any ideas for future podcasts, please contact us. Thanks, everyone.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. If you have any ideas or topics for future episodes, please contact us on Twitter at NJOHSP or email us at intelunclass@njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.